Propagation is every plant parent's best friend because it is a free way to make more plants of the plants that you have for free. Emphasize on free. It's also super fun to watch roots grow and to be able to multiply the plants that you have in your home through different fun setups. Now, propagation is far beyond just taking a couple of pothos cuttings and sticking them in water. Even though that is a great place to start with propagation, there are many more effective, fun, nerdy ways that you can do propagation with different parts of a plant. And that's why today I have propagation expert and friend of the pod, Lindsay Sisti, back to unpack why cuttings fail, why propagation fails, how mold can totally wreak havoc on a propagation setup, how to avoid it, and the simple prop box setup that is going to transform your propagation success. Also, we talk about the importance of humidity when it comes to propagation experiments and propagation setups, but also how humidity can lead to mold and harm in your home and how to avoid it. Lindsay has a very personal experience with this, so we dive deep into this. This episode, you're going to learn practical propagation tips, humidity for plants demystified, and how to set up your prop box, which I am so excited about. Without further ado, here's Lindsay.
Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Plant care is self-care on Growing Joy.
I love the topic of this episode, Lindsay, because I feel like in our sound check, we just like had to turn off all your fans, like all of your humidity management, all of your humidity management that makes too much noise for a podcast just had to be turned off.
Perpetually like a airport in my home.
Yeah, I love it. Well, welcome back, you know, multiple time. What number guest spot is this for you? You've been on the show a bunch now.
I think this is my third. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. And you're my propagation nerd. I've had so much fun nerding out with you this year on propagation. And I'm so excited to talk to you about different methods of propagating plants safely without causing mold damage. You and I both have been traumatized by mold remediation. So this is an important topic. So can you talk just a little bit about like your propagation journey and how you realized humidity was so important?
My gosh. Well, I am located in the Midwest, and anyone who's listening who is in the Midwest just shook their head in camaraderie. And it is crazy, crazy weather swings around here. So we have cold winters and very hot summers. So we are experiencing the extremes in both directions. And So immediately, you know, when you're trying to grow or propagate, especially propagate, and we can get into the science of why later on. But when you're trying to propagate plants in an environment or grow tropical plants in an environment that is very warm or very hot for that matter, or very cold indoors, you're going to be using a lot of heat or a lot of air conditioning, and immediately that's going to dry things up inside. And you'll notice right away, taking that cutting of that pothos or taking a cutting of a monstera and you stick it in water or whatever you stick it in, it's not going to be very happy. So immediately I noticed that I needed for my tropical plants a boost in humidity if I was going to be successful with these plants, especially growing in a environment where the temperatures fluctuated so much outside and requires so much indoor heating and cooling inside.
Yeah. So let's zoom out. These houseplants, these tropical houseplants that we love to keep indoors, what do they like temperature, humidity in their natural environment? Like, what are they used to before we bring them inside?
Right. So, I mean, again, it depends on what type of plant you're growing. You know, of course, succulents don't require much humidity, but if you're growing specifically tropical plants, which is mainly what I grow and breed, is You're talking about monstera's, philodendrons, alocasias. These plants are used to the rainforest. They're mm-hmm. used to these humid tropical environments where the humidity is going to be around 70 to 90, even up to 100% on an average day. Mm-hmm. It's raining on and off throughout the day. It's generally warm. Some of these plants are cloud forest species, so they are high elevation plants. So maybe it gets very cool at night, but regardless, it's going to be misty. So there's a lot of humidity and clouds in the air. So whether it's cool and humid or hot and humid, it's moist all the time. So when we bring them and try to then grow them in our dry suburban or urban or even country homes, they literally just limp to the ground often. And when you take a cutting and cut off the roots, it's even more of a sad situation.
Yeah. I mean, now that I live in South Florida in the summer, I really get a taste of that like rainforest environment where it rains every day. And like, I don't think people understand 80 to 90% humidity feels like when you step outside your house, you are wrapped in a blanket of humid.
Yes.
Like it is a crazy feeling. Then, so that's what our plants like. Then our human bodies, I feel like between like 30 and 60% humidity, like for our skin to be happy and all of that kind of stuff. But then to your point, what people I feel like don't understand is if you're in an environment that uses forced air, whether it's heating or cooling, that mm-hmm. is going to suck the humidity out of your air. And I'll never forget the first time I got hygrometers, which are what you can use to measure your humidity. Mm-hmm. When I was in the mountains and I was in cold weather in the Catskills, my house was 20%, 18 to 20% humidity.
It's crazy.
Which is not good for your human body, let alone your plants. So, you know, that's something that is unseen in plant parent world that a lot of times people don't even understand that it's like a fact. Humidity is a factor in whether or not your plants are happy. When you see brown leaves, when you see crispy edges, when you see those things that people don't understand what's happening if they're correctly watering their plants, oftentimes it can just be like your humidity, which is unseen. And you don't normally, you have a thermostat that measures how cold your house is, but most people don't have a hygrometer in their house that's measuring their level of humidity. So, you know, this episode, we're diving into a really important topic for plant parents, but sometimes it's not necessarily intuitive or, you know, something that like beginners really can grasp or understand very easily.
Right. And one thing that you mentioned, like when you said that when your house gets cool, that you don't realize that it's so dry, that made me realize or remember how this summer was actually, you know, I'm not an HVAC expert by any means. Mm-hmm. And maybe I should be a little ashamed of this, but I went 43 years of my life not fully understanding how an air conditioner worked. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm a plant nerd. I am not an HVAC nerd, but I really didn't have a good grasp that on the fact that an air conditioning literally is pulling the moisture out mm-hmm. of the air of your home. And that is how it is cooling your home, by pulling out the moisture and then running that air over condenser coils. So if you have your air conditioning running in the summer and you're wondering why your plants aren't happy inside, but it's so humid outside, well, it's because your AC is blasting. And I always saw that with my plants. I saw that they weren't happy indoors. And then I noticed that my hygrometer was down. And so I started to run a humidifier in the summer in my plant room because I knew it was so dry. And then the HVAC guy came in and said, no, don't run a humidifier in your plant room in the summer so high, because you're literally fighting against your air conditioning. So there's a lot of factors you have to take in place when you're trying to keep a safe tropical environment for your plants beyond just simply like what's good for my plants. You know, you have to consider your home as well. And we can get into that too. But it was just an interesting thing that I learned that
totally.
Even though it's warm and humid outside, your air conditioning or your heating, and heating is a different reason altogether why It totally dries up your air. But using these HVAC systems dries your interior of your home, which your plants do not like.
Yeah, when I found out I was moving to Florida because of my husband's job, I feel like everybody was like, oh my God, your plants are going to be amazing. Your plants are going to be so happy. Little did I know, like now that I've gotten here, it's like the hardest place to grow houseplants because all the homes are super dark. My new home that I bought has 7 windows total because they, all of the homes in Florida have like awnings over their windows. Think about it. Because the sun is so strong, they, to keep the house cool, like all the windows have UV protectants on them and they keep the homes pretty shaded. And even if you have big windows, like the windows have crazy UV.
Wow.
And you're running your AC year round.
Yes.
So it's been such a funny learning curve that once again, like to your eyes and to your assumptions, you're like, oh, Florida. And I'm like, yeah, my Monsteras are going to be thrilled in my lanai or in my front yard, like because I moved to the tropics, but indoors, not so much. So I feel like some people get stressed about humidity where they're like, if I want to have houseplants, I have to have humidifiers, have a hygrometer, do all these crazy things. Like, when is it actually important to understand humidity? Most people can go without dealing with humidity issues, right?
Right.
When does humidity really become a big aspect of plant keeping?
Right. Most of the house plants that you're going to see sold at a plant shop or a Home Depot or a big box store, wherever you buy your plants, have been hardened off. And what I mean by hardened off is acclimated to more ambient humidity levels or more general humidity levels, such as around 40%, 50%, something that we keep our homes at on a day-to-day basis. So if you see a green Monstera at a store, chances are you're not going to need high humidity for that. If you see a ZZ plant, if you see a snake plant, these plants that are more commonly purchased and sold can thrive in regular humidity levels. When humidity becomes more of a sticking point is when either A, you're dealing with a more uncommon thin leaf or fuzzy leafed plant that comes from the rainforest. And why I say thin or fuzzy leaf is because these leaves are not thick and glossy and they don't have the morphological adaptation to be able to withstand dry air. So they need, so I'm thinking of like your fuzzy begonias or your very thin leafed alocasias. Some of these tropical plants just simply need high humidity. And these are the plants that you may think of that need terrariums or a grow tent or an IKEA cabinet. The plants that maybe you purchase from a rare plant seller or less common plant seller on Etsy, and then you bring it home and you unwrap it and all of a sudden you notice it's wilting after a few days.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the plants that you are really going to want to boost the humidity for. Sometimes a plant simply just needs to adjust from a greenhouse setting to your lower humidity environment. So it will, you know, wilt a little bit and then come back to life. But there's certain other plants like those plants with thin, fuzzy leaves or plants that have shiny leaves, but that are very thin and delicate, that will need to be in a closed environment, like a cloche or a prop box or a grow tent for the remainder of its life in your home, because our indoor environments are just not made for it. And of course, the third category, of course, would be propagations, because you are chopping off the root systems of these plants. And when you chop off the root system or take a cutting, the cutting will not have roots and the roots will not be able to absorb water anymore. And therefore, the leaves rely on the humidity in the air around it, the water vapor around it, to stay turgid or firm. And when the air around the leaves is dry, they're going to wilt. So you need that high humidity around the leaves of cuttings that don't have roots.
And that's where this prop box trend has really taken off.
Yes.
It's
pregnancy, I've been really intentional about what I'm putting in my body, particularly when it comes to sugars and dyes and all the weird stuff that we find in packaged food. And I am so thankful that I have had Manucora Manuka honey in my back pocket for years now as my go-to sweetener for coffees, yogurts, and sometimes just as a little snack on a spoon. You've heard me talk about Manucora honey on this podcast because I use it in my coffee to make my brown sugar shaken espresso dupe. It is this rich, creamy, caramel tasting honey. It's unlike any honey you've ever tasted. Even just by looking at it, you know it's like so much better than your you know, grocery store honey bear. But it's not only delicious, it's ethically produced by Manukora's master beekeepers in the remote forests of New Zealand. And it has bioactives in it that have three times more antioxidants and prebiotics than regular honey. And these help support your cells and gut. And all you need is one heaping teaspoon each morning to get the most out of those bioactives. So if you've been hearing these ads for a while, because you know I've been loving Manucora for years, and you've been curious, now is a great time to try it. Head to manucora.com/bloom to save up to 31% on your first purchase. Plus, you get $25 worth of free gifts with the starter kit. It comes with the MGO 850 plus Manuka honey jar. I've gone through so many of those. 5 honey travel sticks, which are amazing for vacations, a wooden spoon, and a guidebook. So check it out at Manucora, manukora.com/bloom to save 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts.
And it's kind of morphed into like grow boxes now. There's a lot of people who use these prop boxes, not just as prop boxes, but almost as
growing
grow boxes.
Or people that like put basically full greenhouses like inside their house. But I think this is an important point to understand that realistically, for most homeowners and renters, filling your house with multiple humidifiers that are on timers that keep your house between 60 and 80 degrees humidity, like, isn't particularly realistic. When I've tried it, even just the maintenance of refilling the humidifiers over and over and over again, like, for me, it was never sustainable. Maybe in the pandemic, I think for a lot of people it was because everybody was home. But so where people have evolved or where people have gotten really savvy is creating these grow boxes, the IKEA cabinets, gardening under glass with cloches indoors, like creating these miniature humid environments where you can grow whatever you want really successfully. And you can really tinker with that humidity to get the perfect solution without having to risk mold in your house, right? Because yes. You just went through this crazy mold remediation story. Do you want to give us the short version of that story? Yeah.
Yeah, you know me, I'm so great at short versions.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I really will give the very short version. But the short version is that we purchased a 100-year-old home, and we didn't know that it had a lot of very toxic black mold from over the 100-year time period hidden under the plaster, which was also encased in a layer of drywall. No one really knows why, but back in the 1940s, they were renting with plaster and drywall. And my home happens to be very lucky in that they used both on top of each other. So All the mold from any kind of leak that happened in the roof or in the walls from ice dams, which are very common in the Midwest, were concealed. And so I started getting very sick over the last year, which was awesome for me because it coincided right when I was supposed to have my book launch. And yeah, it was really awesome. And so I got very ill, and we did some investigation and we found out in our house, long story short, it was almost like 70% of my home was covered in black mold. And so we had to pretty much rip down like 50% of our walls and put it back up. But in that process, I really had to reconsider my entire plant growing experience because I had a ton of mold experts and environmental and building envelope experts come through here and evaluate the home because we had to figure out whether or not we were going to stay in our home or if we could even afford to like condemn it and leave it at the time. One of the non-negotiables that these building envelope experts kept saying to me was, whoa, the way you're growing tropical plants in here is not okay. Like, you cannot continue like this because, you know, while this mold is from like 100 years of your roof leaks and these ice dams that you had, if you continue in this way, it's going to push the humidity levels and the building envelope to unsafe levels of humidity and water vapor inside the walls over time. And well, that's not okay.
You're basically feeding the mold. Like, that's what mold lives off of, is moisture. So yeah, totally.
Yes. So he was like, you need to keep it 40% humidity in your home. And I said, 40%, but my grow room, my alocasias, they need it to be 60 or 70. Like, they're not going to be, you know, these guys were looking at me like, are you nuts?
Yeah.
You are nuts. And I said, yes, I am nuts. But, you know, these plants, they're my life. And so there were a lot of discussions like that where it was me, you know, sticking up for the alocasias and the guys looking at me like, ma'am, this is your home. This is your health. This is your family. And I said, okay, fine. Like, I get it. So I had to reevaluate that, you know, like, okay, well, and I thought I was fine because I have my entire grow room painted in mold, like three coats of the best, highest quality mold resistant paint. And I don't have any mold on my grow room walls and everything's fine. But what I learned is that humidity travels, and it travels through your air ducts, and it can get into, you know, other rooms of the house in ways that you don't realize. And when temperatures drop outside, mold can form in other places of your home that besides, so say you have one grow room in your house where you're keeping it at 70% humidity, or even something like crazy, like 80% humidity, which I hope no one is, but if you're listening, it's not the wisest idea because that humidity can travel through your return ducts, get in your HVAC system, mold can grow in your HVAC system, and then it's circulated throughout your entire home. And then if temperatures drop, cold air can feed mold and microorganisms and fungi, and then you can end up with mold in other parts of your house as a result.
Because
you want your house, like a dry home, we don't like it for our skin. We don't like it for our sinuses. But a dry home is a safe home from a mold perspective.
Totally.
So the comfort area is around 40%. That will keep mold down and keep you comfortable. And there are so many wonderful, safe ways to grow plants that don't affect your home.
Right.
And so that's what I had to transition to.
Yeah. Like, so let's talk about them. So let's talk about the IKEA grow cap. Let's talk about full-size plants first. So, you know, there was that trend in the pandemic where everybody was getting the IKEA grow cabinets that they were outfitting. People now are putting grow tents in their homes, or like I've seen people put like full greenhouses. We want to speak to the like general houseplant enthusiast here, not the Lindsay, you know, author of plant nerd, author of a propagation book. So what are some easy ways that say you want to keep higher humidity plants like ferns, alocasia, lathia, like the plants that are going to crisp up if you leave them in, you know, 30 to 40% humidity? What are the easiest ways to do that?
Right. Well, I guess what I want to say first are the things that won't work, but I'll say it very quickly.
Okay.
Because I know I've seen videos actually of you covering the things that won't work. And I know that a lot of creators out there, plant creators, make videos about don't do this because it does not work the way you think it's going to. And that is one, pebble trays. So a lot of people think that placing their plants on a tray of pebbles with water is going to increase the humidity by a significant amount for your plant, around your plant. It is not, unfortunately. It might look pretty, but what ultimately happens is slimy algae after a month or two, and or the water simply dries up and then you have to keep refilling that pebble tray. So it's really not going to, if you put a hygrometer next to your pebble trays, you're really going to notice that it does not increase the overall humidity around your plants that much. And it really is a pain in the butt. So pebble trays, not that effective. Grouping your plants together helps very minimally.
Minimally.
It creates a microclimate. Microclimate meaning the area around those plants might be slightly more humid, maybe by like 1%. But really, I mean, we want to talk about how can we increase our humidity from, say, 40% to 60% for these high humidity plants. So those are two methods that people try to use that don't work tremendously. The third method that people try is misting. That used to be really popular. We've all been
talking there. About why misting is a disaster.
So, well, it's interesting. So I wouldn't say it's a disaster in a dry climate. So in a dry environment, if you're misting, really the leaves are just going to, the water is going to just evaporate off the leaves because your air is so dry, the water is going to simply evaporate. And it's going to just be a hand exercise. And it's pretty and it's fun. And you feel like a little fairy and misting your plants and you feel productive. Mm-hmm. You feel really productive. So it's a nice activity. If it's relaxing for you, do it. I mean, of course, everyone likes to like mist their plants. However, it's a disaster if you are misting plants in a humid environment or you have no airflow and you're misting in, say, an IKEA cabinet. And you want like a closed cabinet that doesn't have fans and you want to increase the humidity in that cabinet and you mist everything and then you close the doors and the water sits on the plants and the humidity rises in there. And once the humidity rises and the water sits on the plants, if there's no fans to help with air circulation, and especially if the temperature then drops, which leads to, again, when you have cold air and moisture, mold, fungi.
Fungal. That's when you start to see fungus.
Yep. And bacteria. And that's when you can get fungal blight, bacteria blight on the leaves. So it's kind of like that perfect recipe. If you have cool air, no airflow and or little airflow and water sitting on the leaves. So there's very little evaporation. And so misting is just not the way. It's not the right way.
Yeah. I think as someone who used to mist my plants, like I'm over that. I do, though, I've never heard it the way that you've just said it, which makes me think, you know, you're right. If you have a dry home or like if you want to mist the air around the plants instead of the leaves, so the water isn't sitting on the leaves, if you want to mist to make yourself feel good because you like the act of misting and you like the act of caring for your plants, knowing that that water is going to evaporate really quickly, I guess you can do that. Just know that you're not doing anything for the humidity there. Like you're just doing it. And also like you could mist your plants and then wipe the mist off to clean the leaves. Like that could work.
Right.
Or what I also like to say is if you have your plants on moss poles, you could mist your moss poles all day long because those moss poles are always going to be drying out. Like I have never successfully kept a moss pole like adequately moist for 365 days in a row. So you could be misting those moss poles all day long. So if you want that feeling, that act of tending to your plants
relaxing.
And knowing that you can't be watering your plants every day because you'll overwater, those are two different ways that you could use your misting, you know, your misters that look very beautiful on your bookshelf styled with your plants.
Right.
You know, do that. But just know that like when it comes to humidity, that's not. So you've mentioned the IKEA grow shelf. Let's start with that. So
okay,
how does that work? What are the best practices if you want to do some sort of enclosure where you have all of your like fancy tender plants, your fancy Diva plants?
All right. So some people might be listening and saying, why do they keep mentioning IKEA? Like, what is this about the IKEA grow tent? Because I had a customer the other day purchase a plant from me and she said, well, where do you get your cloches and your boxes? And I said, well, have you joined the IKEA grow cabinet or whatever it's called, the IKEA grow tent or cabinet Facebook group? She said, no, I've never heard of this. And I'm not sure if it's even still around, but I'm pretty sure it is. Facebook group that started during the pandemic for this whole trend of creating grow cabinets out of IKEA. It started, was it the Millsbo cabinet?
Yeah. It's like a bookshelf that's enclosed with glass.
Glass. Yeah. Like a curio cabinet. And it was a glass cabinet and it's the Millsbo. And now there's like three or four different IKEA lines that you can modify. And I obviously caught on to this trend. Modify by taking the shelving out, any glass cabinet, and making it a plant cabinet. Some people take the shelves out and put wire shelving in for their plants to be in it. Some people put acrylic shelving in. Some people like to hang their plants with hooks in the cabinet, but essentially you're just making a glass enclosure for your plants out of these IKEA cabinets. So if you ever dreamed of having a vivarium or any type of beautiful glass display for your plants that kept the humidity in at an affordable price, and that's why a lot of people turn to IKEA. But you don't have to use an IKEA cabinet. A lot of people went on Facebook go on Facebook Marketplace and find any type of used glass cabinet. The reason why IKEA worked well is because it is metal instead of wood that could rot from humidity potentially. And if you use Rust-Oleum paint, so either the spray Rust-Oleum or the actual paint in a can, it will prevent rusting. And that's very important to add a layer of that often, at least on the bottom of the cabinet, to prevent any water that drips from transpiration, which is like plant sweat or guttation, or from extra dripping from watering that might land on the bottom of the cabinet. So that's why IKEA cabinets became extremely popular. They were somewhat affordable and easy to modify to fit plants, and they look really pretty.
They look really pretty. So what do you need, whether you're doing it with the IKEA cabinet or a thrifted curio cabinet from Facebook Marketplace, or no, basically we're making a big ass terrarium, right?
Yeah.
Like making a big
ass terrarium.
Big ass terrarium, or like a big ass Edwardian case is like another one that people would use. What are the elements you need? So you need the glass enclosure.
Get the cabinet and a little bit of a warning. Be careful with the glass because it's tempered glass. And I did shatter one panel on my head.
Okay.
When this glass, it's very easy. Like when you're, if you're drilling and modifying it, the glass panel doesn't crack. It shatters like windshield glass. So you do need to be careful and move it with two people so that it does not shatter. Rust-Oleum. So that is really important, or any product like that where you can paint at least the bottom to prevent it from rusting. The shelves, if you go on these Facebook groups, by the way, there are lists, literally just like a straight up list of supplies you need. But what I did for mine, at one point I had four of them in a row and it was really beautiful. I had four white Milsbo cabinets. And it just looked like a whole wall when you stack them together. Some people put entire walls of these cabinets. So it just looks like a glass wall, like you have a built-in
like a green wall
of plants.
Yeah.
Yes.
Totally.
Yes.
So cool.
It's gorgeous what people do. And how you modify is up to you, whether you have the whole thing, like a big terrarium, or you have shelves where you place your plants. And if you go on Etsy and you search IKEA greenhouse cabinet, there are now people that are like 3D printing shelves or creating custom acrylic shelves that you can put in to the cabinet on different levels to put your small little plants. Or again, like I said, there's hooks that people sell, magnetic hooks. People are even making custom handles that are like the shape of monstera leaves that you can use to open and close. I mean, people get so into decorating it, but the essentials really are just the cat. You just start off with the cabinet.
What about lights? What about grow lights?
That's essential too. I'm getting into all the accessories. I'm like, you could get custom major.
We don't need the Lindsay door openers. I think we need grow lights and fans first.
You could tell what I'm into. I'm like, so then you can paint it rainbow colors. And like, I get so into the decorating. I'm like, oh yeah. You might want some lights too. Okay. So the lights, Barina, and I'm not like advertising for this brand or anything, but there's two brands that people use the most for the IKEA cabinets, and that's Manios and Barina. For the T8 or T5 LED lights that people put in these cabinets, why do people use these two brands? They are the brands that are the least expensive and work well. I mean, I've had mine for
on Amazon.
6 years. They're on Amazon. They're really inexpensive as far as grow lights go. and they just last for, I haven't had one, not, I haven't had one burnout yet, and it's been like 6 years. So, and they come in 2 feet long, which is the perfect length for the cabinet. And you put, generally speaking, it's great to start off with two of these, two T8 lights, or you could use T5. Both work. There's some debates on their T8 or T5 light bulbs. I won't get into the weeds of how the difference between the two, but they're both going to work. You get that two LED bulbs and put them on the top. They look like little strips. So get two strips, stick them to the top of your cabinet, either with magnetic hooks, or some people even drill holes into the top of the metal and then use zip ties. So there's various ways to hang them. And then if you put another shelf, you can hook them onto the second shelf. So 2 to 4 of these 2-foot strips, Manios or Barina. Both brands are like competitors. They both work great. I'm sure by the time anyone's listening to this, there's probably 4 other brands are also working great. But those are pretty much the standard that people are using. And then you'll want a fan for airflow, because we're talking about humidity and we don't want the water sitting on the leaves. We want it to evaporate off the leaves. You might think, well, I'm not going to mist my plants anymore because you told me not to. So there won't be water sitting on the leaves. Well, if your plants are sitting in a closed cabinet and there are a lot of plants and enough plants, the humidity will go up. And there's a lot of different scientific reasons why the humidity is rising. And one of them is because plants transpire. And I mentioned this before, and that's like plant sweating. And transpiration is when plants are releasing water vapor, and they're releasing water vapor through these holes on the leaves called stomata. And when they release the water vapor, that is going to help increase humidity in the tent. And then there's also a process called guttation. And if any of you have ever woken up to little droplets of leaves, little droplets of water at the tip of your leaves.
Looks like your leaves are crying.
Yes. So when you wake up and your leaves are crying, that is guttation. That means there's excess water in your leaves that have not evaporated, probably because you don't have enough airflow, or just simply there was too much water inside the plant, or that it soaked up. Then you need some airflow to get that water out into the air around the plants. So why do we want that water off the leaves? Because we don't want bacteria or fungal infections to begin. So in the tropics, plants are transpiring. Plants have guttation all the time. There's rain on the leaves. They're wet all the time. But they're outdoors. The wind is blowing. The air is flowing. So they're not suffering from bacterial infections. But in your cabinet, the air is completely still. So it's nice to have some airflow. Do we need to obsess over airflow? No, because as many of you might be thinking in your head, well, my plants are fine in a terrarium, or my plants are fine in a prop box, and they don't have a bacterial infection. I think that to myself all the time. It's always my plants in my prop box that seem to do the best. So, you know, I sound a little contradictory here. And that's why I want to say, it's important to understand these processes of transpiration and respiration and photosynthesis and how it works and why guttation is happening. But don't obsess that you need a million fans for airflow, because you're going to get bacterial. Just place a little fan on each level to get that air moving. It will help. It will help the plants. It'll prevent bacterial infection. It will help with the growth of the plant. It will help mimic what's happening in the wild. You'll see online the recommendation for these mini computer fans that are rated to be waterproof. And if you search on Amazon for IKEA cabinet fans, IKEA cabinets have become so popular that if you search on Amazon for IKEA cabinet fans, these tiny little computer fans will come up, and they're rated to be waterproof. You put one on each level and have them on a timer, or just have them running consistently, and that will be great. Your plants will love them. So you've got lights, fans, and that's pretty much what you need. Some people add pebble trees. I've added pebble trees to mine only when I have only a couple plants in there and I absolutely need the humidity to go up.
Yeah.
But that's only when you absolutely need to. And the pebble tray will work in the, I know I just like poo-pooed pebble trees and now I'm saying it. In the cabinet, it will work because it's a closed environment and the water is evaporating and then comes back down.
Right.
So it's a water
enclosed. Source. Right. That's the way. The reason why the pebble trays don't work in a home is that the water evaporates, like the humidity escapes into the entire room instead of into this enclosed environment. You've mentioned prop box. So IKEA grow cabinets, you can Google, but you need your glass enclosure, you need a fan, you need a grow light, and you'll figure it out.
Yes.
Let's talk about prop boxes because you are the propagation queen. And no longer are we just putting tip cuttings in water and propagating them. Prop boxes now are all the rage for people.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you have a lot of opinions on prop boxes. So for those who don't know what one is, it's a propagation box. Mm-hmm. And people have found that they're finding way more success rooting their plant propagations in these box setups than with a glass of water on their kitchen counter or in their kitchen window. So can you talk about some best practices for prop boxes?
Yes, yes. And prop boxes are a best, and IKEA cabinets are best practice for keeping humidity. Just to circle back to your question, is to keep humidity out of your home and out of
retained
your HVAC system.
Yes.
Yes. So, and people who are listening can't see behind me, but behind me right now in my grow room, which used to be a shelf of plants that were open, is out in the open. And I had so many humidifiers running. Now I simply have one little humidifier for the room to keep the room at a comfortable 40% humidity. Mm-hmm. And then my high humidity wanting plants, my divas, are, or my little bitches, oops, can I say that? But I have other names for them that are, I cannot say on this podcast, but some of them are just ridiculous. Some of these rainforest endemic alocasias need prop boxes within prop boxes. And so they are all on shelves in prop boxes now, because no longer am I catering to their needs out in the open in my home. So prop boxes.
So they graduated. A prop box is something you graduate from. You put a clipping in, you propagate it, you take it out,
yes,
you pot it up. These are grow boxes. These are boxes,
yeah,
where these plants are going to live full time. This is their full time life because they need the high humidity for their entire life cycle, lifetime. And so they're living in these boxes so you can contain the humidity that they need.
That's true. That's a good clarification. Although in my mind, I still call them prop boxes.
Right.
Because they're the same boxes. So, but yes.
It's the same. Right. They're just a little bit bigger.
Right. Well, no, not even. I use these for propagation too.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm propagating so much. But you're right. You're right. Prop boxes are, it's kind of become a general term for any clear tote for that you're growing these plants. And sometimes when they're done propagating, I just leave them in this box for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you're going to live in your prop box for the rest of your life.
Prop,
you are just condemned to your prop box. Yes. So a prop box, the elements of a prop box that you need is any clear container. So it can be a small box. And what I mean by small is it has to be obviously larger than the plant cutting that you're taking.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, the smallest that you want to go with a prop box is the size of a tall plastic shoebox, they're often called. If you imagine what your shoes come in, like a brown cardboard box, but stack two of them on top of each other, that would be the size of a clear plastic shoebox. And then you have a large plastic tote, and then you have extra large plastic totes that I use to grow massive and propagate massive pieces of philodendrons and monsteras. So you can make them as big as you want to.
If you want to just play around and just try this for fun, you could do a takeout delivery box, right?
Yeah. Well, My gosh, you can use your Chinese takeout soup cart container.
Right, the soup containers. Yeah.
Yes. If you wanted to propagate something small, like a tiny node from your pothos, and just chop a little piece of your pothos, and maybe we'll talk about that in another podcast episode. A little teaser. But we'll propagate a node of your pothos and throw it in a Chinese wonton soup takeout container. That's actually, you could do that. You could do that. That would be like a very tiny, like singular prop box, prop box unit. And so the elements you want for a prop box is the minimum, the bare, bare minimum is some kind of substrate. Substrate meaning soil.
The thing it's going to grow in. Yeah.
Perlite. Anything that you are going to grow the plant in, and you want it to be, the word everybody loves, moist. Mm-hmm. So, and when I say moist, I like to tell people as wet as a wrung out sponge. And that's very important because if it's saturated, and we're going to use, let's say sphagnum moss, or I always say it wrong. I'm sorry. Sphagnum moss. I will never not say sphagnum though, but sphagnum moss, because it's light and fluffy and it's used a lot in propagation boxes. So if you take sphagnum moss and it's saturated with water, I mean, just dripping wet when you pick it up, that is going to cause too much humidity, too much moisture. And that is when you're going to see rotting of your propagations. Mm-hmm. And that is why sphagnum moss, even though it is an amazing propagation substrate, one of the best out there, it gets a bad rap. Because people say, well, my propagation's rotted in sphagnum moss. Well, you probably had it sopping
You wet. Had it too wet. Okay.
And then it becomes completely, completely saturated, and it basically drowns your cuttings. Mm-hmm. You have an environment where there's not enough oxygen. Roots need oxygen to grow.
So what do your prop boxes look like for propagations, not for long-term growing, but for propagations? Are you doing sphagnum? Are you doing LECA? Are you doing kind of a combo platter of stuff? Like, what are you doing?
I like the combo platter.
Yeah, of course you do.
Right. Of course I do. So what I generally like to do is so what I was going to say is that you could use just a layer of sphagnum moss or a layer of substrate, any substrate you want, but preferably you have a drainage layer on the bottom. Why? Just to capture the water.
Okay.
And excess water. Right. If there is any dripping, just to keep it down there. So what I'll do personally is I'll put a layer meaning like 1 or 2 inches of perlite on the bottom. What this does is captures the excess water, if there is any, from the sphagnum moss, which then goes on top. The sphagnum moss, its purposes is for all the roots to grow in. So if I'm growing teeny tiny plants that will have teeny tiny roots, I only need enough sphagnum moss where those roots will grow in. If I'm growing giant plants or plants that are going to have large root systems, I might need 3 inches, 4 inches, 5 inches of sphagnum moss. Mm-hmm. So adjust accordingly in your prop box. That also means your prop box needs to be tall enough to accommodate all of this substrate. So that's why I like to buy tall shoe boxes. Well, I'm specifically speaking because when you go to the store, you want to buy. When I go to the container store, they sell the tall shoe box. And I love those because they're small and tall and they're clear. And it gives me enough height for new shoots to grow and the roots to grow down. And that's perfect for me. And then the other element is that you want enough space, air space, for the new shoots to grow. If you don't have enough air space on top of the substrate, the shoots are going to grow right up to the top of your prop box. And when the leaves transpire and have guttation, the water moths are going to hit the prop box sides or the top. And there's also this phenomenon called evapotranspiration that occurs in propagation boxes where the water evaporates off of the substrate and transpiration happens at the same time. And that's why you'll see the little water molecules on top of, and I think that's a cool nerdy term, evapotranspiration. And then that water droplets that are on top of your propagation box, then the water cycles back down. And that's why you usually don't have to re-moisten a prop box if you keep the lid closed, because the water keeps cycling. However, if you haven't left enough room for your plant to grow shoots. That plant shoots will hit the top. The water will then cycle back down on top of the leaf. And that's where you can get leaf damage, bacterial infections, and so on and so forth. So leave enough air space, leave enough root space, and have a little drainage layer, and it's perfect. And the last thing I will say, because people use this term a lot lately, is burping your prop box, where they lift the lid and let in some fresh oxygen. It is not a bad habit. I do it every once in a while where I'll open the lids, but it's mainly because I'm checking in on things. I've had some of my best prop boxes grow where I completely forget about them for a couple months, and then I open it up and it's literally some of the best plants I've ever grown in there. Because sometimes the best things grow when you don't touch them. It's like Murphy's Law in plant parenting, but I think it's a great
Are you giving them light as well? Like when you say, sometimes my best prop boxes, like I forget about them for a couple of months. Are they in the dark or are they under a grow light?
That's a great question. So light is absolutely critical. No plant can grow in complete darkness. Photosynthesis is absolutely necessary for plant growth, and light is necessary for photosynthesis. So we absolutely need to plant these cuttings in the prop box and put the prop box under either a grow light or put it in a window so that it gets natural light. And if you're putting it under a grow light, my rule of thumb, because I know some people are thinking, well, how do we know how close to a grow light or how many? A great place to start is try about 2 feet under your grow light. And I know it depends on how strong your grow light is and how many grow lights you're using. Everything always depends. But if you're using those Barina grow lights, those T8 or T5 grow light strips, and you're using two of them, like I just mentioned before, which is kind of, I don't want to say the standard, but in those IKEA cabinet situations that I was describing earlier, which is how a lot of people are growing and propagating plants, people are using two LED T8 or T5 bulbs next to each other. And if you have that set up, try placing your prop box 1 to 2 feet underneath those grow light bulbs. And you'll know right away, keep monitoring from there. I know this is not the super scientific method where I'm giving you PPFD measurements of exact placement. Use your intuition, use your growing knowledge. Is you know, growing science is also an experience. So take a look each week. You'll notice, are your plants stretching out or not growing? Maybe they need to be closer to the light. And if you see any, you know, yellowing or leaf burn, maybe you need to move them a little farther. But if they're about 1 to 2 feet from your grow light in a prop box, they should be doing just great.
So let's take an eye. Promise, even though I'm moving in a week, I promise my audience, I will do my very best to capture this in an Instagram reel for you for the sake of science. I have a Raphidophora tetrasperma that was gifted to me 8 years ago from a listener. Its name is Raffy. He's like well known with the audience. Okay. When I moved to Florida, I put Raffy in my lanai and he's been happy climbing in my lanai, like climbing up the area. We got a weird frost this year and Raffy, all the leaves turned black and fell off. But we've got the vine. We've got like, it looks like a runner now. So my thought is I don't have a prop box going, but I think it would be fun to make a prop box specifically to try and rehabilitate Raffy, mostly with node cuttings. So
amazing.
If you were me and you had this thing happen, you want to start a prop box, it's going to be mostly node cuttings. Because I think a lot of people probably have like a leggy pothos or like a leggy philodendron or something like that, where like they want to just like beef it up.
Right.
How would you walk me through step by step what I'm going to do? So I'm going to get the tall shoe box.
Right.
I ordered that on Amazon today.
Right. Right. A tall shoe box, really any clear tote, any clear Rubbermaid or whatever brand, Sterling, clear plastic tote that will fit all of the nodes after, you know, that you anticipate that you want to propagate. Then you're going to take sharp, sterilized cutting shears. So take a little rubbing alcohol and rub them on your cutting shears to make sure they're nice and clean, don't have bacteria on them. And then you're going to cut along the internodes, which is the space, that smooth space between each of Raffy's nodes. And you can tell where the nodes are because that's where the bumps are in the stem. Where you
They're like knuckles.
Yeah, little knuckles.
Yeah.
Where a lot of times on the knuckles, you'll see the little aerial roots poking out. So cut along the internose, which is where there's no knuckles and it's nice and smooth. Have a bunch of little, which will look like little green beans with a knuckle in the middle. So those are your little green beans, multiple little raffies. Then you're going to set those little nodes to the side. So we're going to prep our prop box now that you have. And on the bottom, you're going to put a drainage layer. So what do you have? Do you have perlite or do you have more LECA?
I have it all. I have LECA, I have perlite, and then I have the aquarium substrate that we've worked with before as well.
Fluval stratum.
Yeah.
Okay, we don't want to waste fluval stratum for a drainage layer. No.
I've got perlite or LECA, whichever you prefer.
Okay. So whatever one is less expensive for you to use, meaning like if you don't use LECA for other stuff, it's great to use on the bottom. Or if you got your perlite for super cheap and you have tons of it, throw it on the bottom. Either one, make, you know, an inch, at least 1 inch would be great. Throw it on the bottom of your prop box, like a layer, like a cake, you're making a cake. So spread that drainage layer on the bottom. And then on top, you're going to put, do you have sphagnum moss? Perfect. Okay. So before we put the sphagnum moss in, some people like to rip it up and make it really small. Mm-hmm. And other people like to just throw it in. Honestly, it will be fine if you just leave it as is. You don't have to chop it up in this case.
Okay.
Your propagations are going to work just fine. So let's keep it simple. Let's put that, take a big hunk of it and put it in a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to fill that bowl with some warm water. Warm water helps to hydrate it faster.
Okay.
So from your sink, or if you have special water that you like to use, you can use, you know, some people like to use reverse osmosis water for their plants, or blessed water, or holy water. I don't know what you use for your plant,
okay.
But tap warm tap water will work just fine. I promise. And you're going to hydrate the moss. And then after, how moist do you want it to be?
Squeezed out sponge, no drip.
Yes, exactly. Like a wrung out sponge. So you're going to literally pick it up and wring it out like a sponge until it's all wrung out. And then you're going to place it on top, again, like a cake, on top of the perlite. I was trying to think if you chose LECA or perlite. Yes, on top of the perlite. And again, because you're using like a medium-sized plant here, I mean, it's kind of a petite plant. It doesn't have tiny, tiny roots, but doesn't have huge roots. But Raphidophora tetrasperma is going to have maybe like, well, we're going to wait for the roots to be about a half inch and a half long. So put about 2 inches of sphagnum moss down on top of the perlite. The thing is, you always want to wait until the roots are 1.5 inches at least before you transfer them to its final destination, like a pot of aeroid mix. However, something huge like a giant monstera will just go crazy. So you want to put a little extra moss in there because you might forget about it and then it just starts growing like crazy. Another thing I'll note, it's okay if you have a little drips in your moss because the extra drainage layer is going to catch that extra water in this case. But you just don't want it to be sopping wet.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your nice prop box, you have a layer of perlite, you have that thick layer of sphagnum moss. Now on the side, you have your little green beans with a knuckle in the middle, or as people used
to call them, wet sticks. Should I let those nodes callus for a day before I put them in the prop box?
Okay. So that's a great, great question. And something that I go back and forth with a lot of my propagations, and like a lot of plant questions, it depends. It depends on the plant. It depends on whether or not you're sticking the end in the substrate, the cut end in the substrate. In this case, we are going to be laying the individual sticks on top of the substrate.
Mm-hmm.
So the ends aren't going to have a lot of opportunity to soak up a lot of excess water and rot because they're going to be laying on top of the substrate. the roots, the new roots are going to form from the middle of these green beans, so to speak, these little cut pieces. And so because of that, there's not a huge risk for rot here. It's also a green plant, correct? It's not a variegated plant. Mm-mm. And because it is a non-variegated plant with a lot of chlorophyll, it's going to grow roots fairly quickly, given the right amount of light, a warm temperature, and humidity. And once it starts growing roots, those roots are going to start taking up water and things are going to move pretty quickly. And rot will have a lot less opportunity to start taking place. So it's less important when you're dealing with non-variegated plants and plants that are hardier and plants in which you're not going to be sticking that cut end directly into a wet substrate, such as if you were taking a rhizome cutting of, say, like chopping off the bottom of an anthurium and then sticking it into a substrate and the bottom would be getting wet. And then it would soak up rot.
Have to worry about rooting hormone or anything else, too. It's just water hydrated sphagnum moss.
You don't have to worry about rooting hormone, although rooting hormone is definitely a great option if you want to speed things up. So what I wanted to say is, no, you do not have to let it callus, but you can let it callus. It will reduce the risk of rot, but the risk of rot in your situation with Raffi is pretty low to begin with.
Okay.
But if this was a variegated Monstera, absolutely, I would say let it callus over a little bit because variegated Monstera are little biatches. And if the ends even look at something moist, they're like, I'm going to just rot just because they have less chlorophyll and the roots are going to take longer to take hold.
Okay.
And they're just going to sit longer.
Okay. All right. So, but if I like have 2 days, you know, I have 30 minutes today, I cut down the plant, chop it up, let them callus. And then tomorrow I put the box together. I can let them callus, I guess.
Now, yeah, you can.
What happens with, I've done this before with prop boxes that I've noticed and I know other people have is mold. So what happens if mold grows on the top of the sphag?
Okay. So are we talking like
white mold?
Okay. I was going to say, I just want to clarify because some people listening might think that the green that forms the top of sphagnum moss is mold. And I just want to clarify that green is the algae. And a lot of people think that's mold who are just starting off. But the white mold certainly happens. And that is one reason why it's so important that when we start off, everything is sterilized so that our hands are clean, the cutting shears are clean, that we are not introducing extra bacteria or spores into the workspace because anything extra into the space can cause mold. However, mold still happens, especially if you're dealing with decaying plant matter, like decaying leaves that can get moldy in the humid environment. And if it's a humid, cold environment, especially white mold can form even more. It's less likely that white mold will happen in the warm, humid environment. But the white mold is totally a normal part of growing. Don't freak out if you see it. There's a few things you could do. One, remove the white mold and replace it with fresh sphagnum moss. And it doesn't mean that your plants are bad either. It's totally normal. And two, the other thing that you'll want to have just as a grower is a spray bottle of hydrogen peroxide, diluted hydrogen peroxide. So I use the, let me grab my bottle here. It's one part hydrogen peroxide to four parts of water, and I keep it diluted and I spray it on the mold whenever I have it.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, that spray bottle's always with me.
So I'm putting one layer of my nodes on top of the sphagnum moss, and then I'm closing the top and I'm putting it in my window.
Yep.
And then how long am I waiting? Am I burping it? Am I opening and closing it? What are the next steps?
Right. And you mentioned rooting hormone powder, which is optional. If you have some on hand, rooting hormone powder or gel is awesome.
I have the gel you recommended me.
Awesome. The gel is great. So you can dip the center of the nodes, where the nodes are in the gel and put it in. That will speed things up for sure. But if you're not in a hurry, and especially if it's summertime, it's going to be fast anyway, because it's nice and warm and propagation will go faster. So place the lid on, place it in bright light, and you are good to go. You do not need to burp it. However, burping term really gets me. Just having had three babies, it's just so funny. That
right, that's funny. Plans. Yeah.
Especially you soon. But I know, you'll be burping soon. So yeah, you'll have to burp the baby, and then you'll have to burp your
And burp my propagations.
Exactly. Raffy and the baby.
Raffy Take and turns. The baby.
But yeah, you don't need to burp. But I think burping just happens naturally when you are checking on your propagations. And you always want to check on your propagations because, again, the best way to stop mold from really being a problem is checking on your propagations. You know, once a week or once every other week, take a look. And, you know, if something starts to rot or mold, remove that one piece of stem, and then you spritz the one part hydrogen peroxide to four parts water on top of it, and it should be good to go. So just check on it. You don't have to burp. I mean, think about the terrariums.
Did you say, and then you said, I'm waiting for the roots to get 2 inches into the sphagnum moss before I'm transplanting them?
Yes, yes. 1.5 inches is the minimum typically. You could transfer them sooner into aeroid mix if the roots are small and you want to do it sooner, and then you transfer it. But ideally, I mean, people do all sorts of things. The reason why I say you could do it sooner is because there's someone listening that's like, I only do it when my roots are 1/2 inch and they're fine.
Right, and they're fine.
And you can, because if you're in a very tropical environment, I mean, we all know, like, you could throw anything into a pot of soil and it's going to grow. But if you're not so blessed to be in a tropical-like environment and you live in the shitty Midwest, you will want to wait till your roots are at least 1.5 to 2 inches long, just to give that plant a little extra support so that it's nice and sturdy. So it gives it a little leg room. When you transfer it to a pot of soil, a pot of aeroid mix, or fluvial stratum, or
I'm going to add it to my green wall because I have my green wall is my best light indoors. So I'm going to clear one of my ecos in my green wall planters, and then probably just like line up the different node cuttings to make like a nice robust pot of raffy. And then as the vines grow, I'll train them to like climb all over the wall. I think that'll look really cool.
That will look really pretty.
Yeah.
I love Raffidophora when they
climb, baby.
Yes.
And my
You'll want to wait.
Okay. Okay. And then also, is there spacing requirements for how far apart the nodes I should put in the sphagnum moss, or can I crowd them a little bit?
You can crowd them for sure. Just don't let them touch each other. And okay. I made the grave mistake recently of throwing a bunch of alocasia corms, threw them on top of each other in a container. I just did not have time or energy, and I had way too many corms, and I threw them on top of each other in a bunch of sphagnum moss. And it was actually in a Chinese food takeout plastic. Mm-hmm. And I forgot about it. And honestly, I'm still traumatized. Like, and not by the look of it, but the smell was...
they all touched and rotted.
Few of them rotted. And then I forgot about it and I opened it up. And I swear it had to be... I've never smelled a corpse flower in person. This had to be worse than any corpse flower. It was like death and garbage and vomit all together. And so don't make my mistake. Don't let your props touch each other, because if one goes bad, the mold will take over the other ones. And
especially if you forget them.
Trauma.
I think that's the perfect place for us to leave off. This was so fun. I could talk to you about prop boxes for like
five more hours.
Well, I think too, like in this episode, we dove into some nerdy stuff. We dove into humidity. Yes. We dove into best practices. We dove into these things. But like at the end of the day, especially propagation, which we're going to do a whole nother episode on, but like,
right,
this is all fun, you know, like an IKEA grow house. That's fun. Like,
right.
You're lucky if you have the disposable income to like build out an IKEA grow house for yourself and your plants, right? Like a prop box is way lower stakes, obviously, but like this is all fun. The stakes are low here. Just try. And right. also know that every single influencer you have ever followed on the internet, including Lindsay and myself, has made a prop box or made some sort of propagation thing and then completely forgotten about it. And it's dried up. And the nodes inside have totally gone crispy and or moldy and or rotted. Like, no one is perfect at this. And a lot of this is, you know, trial and error and figuring out what works for you. Like I just said, I have to build this Raffi prop box in the middle of my move because we're moving the container that he was in. You know, we'll see if it's successful or not. We're going to be in my new house, but you know, the stakes can be low. And also that also just speaks to like, always take a few more propagations than you think you want to take so that you have some left, you know, you have some backups. But you are the propagation queen. Where can people find you and where can people find your book? Because if people want to get into propagation and if they want to get into this kind of nerdy next level plant parenthood, your book is a great place to start.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. So my book is The Ultimate Guide to Houseplant Propagation, and it can be found at any local bookstore. Well, any online bookstore, I should say. Your local bookstore may or may not have it, but I always love to support local bookstores, but check online. And of course, it's going to be on Amazon and Target and all the big ones.
When you order your lights and your, you know, and
add it to
plastic shoe boxes, you can add it to your cart. Yeah.
And it's crazy, crazy comprehensive. So if you think I talk a lot, I write a lot. And so there's lots of beautiful pictures and step-by-step instructions of how to propagate all of these tropical plants and succulents too, believe it or not. They made me write about succulents. No, yeah, I love succulents.
I think the visual is important, especially with propagation. Yes. Like, it's one thing to just talk about it. It's another thing to kind of see it. So that's why, once again, I'm going to do my best to make video documentary, graphy situation. But yeah, you're the best, Lindsay. And
you're the best.
No, you are.
No, you.
Well, I can't wait to have you back on very soon for another chat.
Thanks, Maria. Good luck with Raffi.
Thanks. All right, plant friends, I hope this episode helps. If your propagations have been failing or have been getting, you know, covered in that mold, I hope this conversation helps. I bought everything for my prop box and then I cut up Raffi, like I talked about in my right before I moved. And I put the node cuttings that I took in my car and my car got like 100 degrees and fried the node cuttings. I'm so sad. So I only have a bouquet of tip cuttings from Raffi in water. But sadly, the prop box for Raffi did not work. But I now do have the plastic shoe container Lindsay recommended. And I have my sphagnum moss and my aquarium soil. So I need to set up my prop box with other propagations now that I bought everything. But like, that was such an epic propagation fail on my part. But listen, you got to give yourself grace when you move. That was a crazy move. Anyway, I would love to hear your more successful experiences with propagation. Please tag me online at Growing Joy with Maria. Send me pictures. I want to see your prop box setups or your propagation stations. It really can be such a joyful experience to take a clipping of something and then watch it totally burst into life. My sister just the other day told me that, or sent me a picture of a Monstera that I gave her. It was a tiny propagation from one of my Monsteras. And now it's like an epic eight-inch pot of a beautifully fenestrated Monstera. And so fun that that was a propagation from one of my plants. Many, many moons ago. All right. I've yapped enough with you. I hope this was fun. Let me know what other plant nerdy episodes you'd like to have Lindsay back on for. And until next time, my sweet plant friends, keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test.
It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.